I'm Rachel, the creative director for Ram Dass's Love Serve Remember Foundation, and I'd like to welcome you to our Inner Academy, a virtual Dharma hall where our family of wisdom teachers will help you navigate your daily life by bringing ancient wisdom into a modern context. With over 200 hours of audio and video teachings, meditations, and practices from teachers like Ram Dass, Krishna Dass, Sharon Salzberg, Jack Kornfield, Roshi Joan Halifax, Joseph Goldstein, and many more, the Inner Academy is your core resource for finding balance, presence, and navigating the ups and downs of your daily life. The Inner Academy has guidance for every step of your journey. Choose from an annual or monthly membership and gain access to past and future courses, retreat replays, virtual community, and much more. If you've been familiar with Love Serve Remember Foundation for a while, you'll know that most of our offerings are given freely or on a sliding scale basis. So when you subscribe to the Inner Academy, you're paying it forward and bolstering our ability to continue creating accessible offerings for all in the future, as Ram Dass wished for us to do. Be here now and start your journey with Ram Dass's Inner Academy today. For more, visit ramdass.org/innerAcademy.
Teaching meditation can be a deeply rewarding experience. Help others improve their mental and emotional well-being, reduce stress, improve focus, increase self-awareness and self-regulation, all while deepening your own practice and understanding. Join acclaimed author, Buddhist teacher, and Emmy Award-winning musician David Nickturn on Tuesday, May 28th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time for a free online discussion on teaching meditation in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/be-here-now for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nickturn on May 28th.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
The reason I'm meditating is so that the next time I'm sitting in front of a Hanuman statue experiencing some transcendent bliss, I'm not drowning it out with the machine gun rattle of 70 questions regarding what that is.
Hi, Duncan.
Hey, how you doing?
Good to see you.
Good to see you, too. Good to see you, David.
Can you hear us okay, Duncan?
I hear you fine. Do I sound okay?
Yep.
You do.
Yeah, we're all good.
Beautiful.
So just to give maybe many people know the antecedents of the Be Here Now podcast network, which is in its sixth anniversary. We have a whole program going around for its sixth anniversary. And so this is an oft-repeated story, but it's worth, especially given the anniversary of the network. Duncan, who had known about Ram Dass from early age through his mom, and then and sort of ignored it for a while, then came back to it, and then eventually found Ram Dass and a way to speak directly to him, because Ram Dass used to do Skype. Individual Skype sessions, which he did, and got inspired enough to write to Info, because he didn't know who I was, and say, you ought to do a podcast, because you could just take some of Ram Dass's talks and introduce them, and it'll be very popular. Well, 6 or 7 years later, I think we started before the network, actually, here we are with this extraordinary network with such a robust platform of listeners, and now includes people like Alan Watts and Jack Kornfield, Sharon, who was here earlier today, Sharon Salzberg, Joseph Goldstein, and David Nickturn, who just joined about a year ago, I think. Yeah.
Mm. That is such... I will never accept credit for that. That's like, there's radio, and then TV comes, and your friend has a radio show, and you say, maybe you should do a TV show. It's not really like... anything that I did, but I will accept the I'll accept whatever that is. It just didn't, you would have done it no matter what.
No, I had no idea, even though I had been in radio and I knew enough to know what it was, but there was a modus operandi in many different ways that you forget. You took me through, gave me the exact names of all the equipment that I needed.
Oh, it's very complex.
Yes, it is. I know.
You need a microphone and a computer. I think I probably told you need a microphone and a computer.
It was a big inspiration at the very least, okay?
Okay, thank you. I'll accept that.
Yeah, it's, and I'm still going to call you Guruji, absolutely.
Okay.
All right. So, but what happened is, so, and then Duncan came along to retreats in Maui and met Ram Dass. That's a whole other story. And... as he did that and talked about it on the Duncan Trussell Family Hour, many, many, many next-gen people started coming to the retreats and introduced, Ram Dass was introduced to a whole new segment. And that changed things up in a big way, because that's what Ram Dass wanted. He wanted to make sure that these teachings and this information and legacy got out to the next generation on platforms that they were used to connecting with. And then he slowly, Duncan slowly got into the rhythm of Hindu bhakti thing and dealing with the reality of what Neem Karoli Baba is. It was wonderful. Then one day, he turned on us. And off he went into this Buddhist thing, which he's never returned from, and we've never recovered. And this man...
it's his fault.
It's his fault. So tell me, you guys, tell me what really happened there.
David made more sense.
All right, well, that's a good point. Now, I want you to tell me how David made more sense, because this is...
Look, I'm so sorry. That was a cheap joke.
It's not a joke, though, because this retreat is called, one of the subtitles is Love and Reason. So sense is part of reason.
Right.
You unfortunately just dismissed the love and went right to the reason.
See, you bhakti people. It's always like that, isn't it? You dismiss the love. Well, look, I don't know. Maybe I did. I just, the way, you know, what I love about those retreats is that it's set up for all kinds of minds, you know, not just, you know, there's so many different, obviously everyone has a different way of looking at the world. And some people are going to be drawn to burning incense in front of deities and the bhakti thing. I've chanted Hare Krishna myself. I still do, but you know, the way my mind is, you know, I had some, I think, precursor stuff before I got to the other stuff that I still am working on, you know, and I think that's where the Buddhist stuff is quite pragmatic, I guess is the best way to put it, is because there isn't really the way my mind works. And I think the reason David and I, one of the reasons we started our friendship, there's a lot of reasons, was because at one of these retreats, I think I was asking you, if everything changes, what about Hanuman? Does Hanuman die?
Hanuman, is that what you said?
Yeah.
Excuse me?
Don't you remember?
No.
Nick Turn said Hanuman's impermanent. And when you were on the stage in Maui?
Yeah, I know. I don't remember what he said. Yeah.
And then we were trying to vet whether the deities are in the impermanent realms.
Oh, I see.
Remember?
Yeah.
Coming back?
Yeah.
So, but everybody's got to figure that out for themselves, don't you think?
Yeah.
Yeah, I sure don't remember what your answer was for that. I'd love to hear it. What is What is the general answer when it comes from that worldview regarding the permanence of deities?
I have no idea whatsoever. I also, when I went to India, like Ram Dass, I wasn't that into Hinduism and the myriad of gods and goddesses and statues and all of it. But somehow, after we were introduced to Hanuman, and particularly the Hanuman Chalisa, and a couple of the statues that were representing him that Maharaji had in his ashrams, I suddenly started... It was a connection that I could not put in words, but it felt good, so I didn't care. And then this representation, a statue of Hanuman that was Ram Dass arranged and was brought to Taos, New Mexico, where it resides today, and it was created by Sidhi Ma K.K. Shah, Ram Dass's Indian brother, and it is absolutely extraordinary in its transmission, particularly of compassion.
Yeah.
And the way that I connected with that was beyond me thinking about, you know, any of these kinds of issues in terms of, I mean, people say, well, this is a myth, isn't it? So what do you, you know, I go, I have no idea, except that when I sit and do the Chalisa in front of that statue, there's a deep connection that happens. And whenever I do the Chalisa on a regular basis, but in times of trouble, Mother Mary comes to me through Hanuman.
That's beautiful. Yeah, I think you would be. I know exactly what you're talking about. When I was younger and started going to the Hare Krishna temples, I felt that what I don't know what that is, and certainly in front of the retreats, you know, sitting in front of the Hanuman deity, you experience something that's so profound and beautiful, and honestly, like it's a prerequisite for you to enjoy the effect of whatever that may be. The thing has to be eternal. I think that's, you're setting the bar a little too high, right? Like, who cares? I don't know. Does he get old? I don't know. Does his body break down like human bodies break down? Is there entropy in that world? That's how my mind works, which is why it's nice just to meditate so I can learn how to not get stuck.
A left-handed put down there. Yes. Well, Hanuman, you know, may be eternal or might be that it's temporal. And you're just meditating because, you know, the reason has really encouraged you to that, you know, becomes a path that you can grasp.
Right? Yeah, no, I didn't mean a left. I mean, like, the reason I'm meditating is so that the next time I'm sitting in front of a Hanuman statue experiencing some transcendent bliss, I'm not drowning it out with a machine gun rattle of 70 questions regarding what that is. Can it be quantified? What if I invented a device to measure it? Can we measure this? Is there a way to, like, understand what it is? Maybe it's a potential power source. Can we power our homes with it? Is this some kind of, you know what I mean? This is why meditation works as a nice, creating some space so that when you are lucky enough that you might be experiencing that, you can let your mind prattle on about that stuff without being swept into one of those questions and suddenly you're writing some like essay about the Hanuman, new element or something, some ridiculous short story or whatever. This is why I think the two work very well together, even though within, if you want to break it up into two categories, those two categories, you do find like some wonderful pushback. You know, I always loved that Ram Dass would bring the bhaktis and the Buddhists together. And I always enjoyed the many hilarious, never-ending conversations, like the one Ram Dass would have with Roshi Joan Halifax. I mean, I can remember sitting at the table when you brought me over there, and Ram Dass said, you know, this is just my fantasy. And Roshi Joan goes, finally, after all these years, you admit it. And I realized, oh my God, this playful communication between them has been going on for their entire lives. And I think there's really something beautiful in that, whatever that is beneficial for these two things that seem like potentially different sides, but they're not really that different at all.
Yeah.
We're just right, but that doesn't mean anything.
Your thoughts?
Well, I had a nice conversation with one of the people here yesterday, and I asked him, do you follow the path of the heart or the path of clarity? And he said, path of the heart. I said, try the other one. And I think these particular gatherings that we have illuminate both the path of the heart and the path of clear seeing. So if you lean towards one side, you know, I'm from the middle way tradition within the Buddhist world, and the two extremes that we avoid are theism and nihilism, right? Those are the two extreme views. So if you've fixated strongly on the external existence of a deity or money or your own existence as a kind of fixed, solid entity, you need more clarity, because you can easily dismantle that with just a few clear perceptions about the nature of your own existence, for example, which you can see is clearly impermanent. This gathering is impermanent. We're getting more and more impermanent every minute. So impermanence begins, you know, but if you attach to the impermanent side, then it becomes nihilistic. And, you know, there's an attachment to the negation. So I don't think there's any discrepancy at the end of the day, but it depends on the individual practitioner and what they're working with in terms of their own mind stream. And for some people, just dropping the intellectual paraphernalia and just finding something they can really connect with through the heart and love is really a great path, really beautiful. And so I've been enriched personally by these gatherings. I'm very grateful to Raghu and KD and Ram Dass, because I feel there's a nurturing energy here and everybody's welcome. And I personally have felt welcomed and included. So I think that's the biggest picture. Within that, you know, we're trying to find a way to be. I think isn't that what we're all sharing? Finding a way to be, a way to be genuine, a way to be, have a good human life. And that's by far the most important umbrella dimension of it. So that's what I would say.
And that's pretty much what we are, the theme of the retreat, that what David just expressed really points to it, I believe. You know, Bob is here, Bob Thurman. Duncan, you remember Bob?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I love him.
Yeah, he's been a lot of fun and a lot of wisdom at the same time, which is what he is. But he, so everybody here, I want to introduce to Duncan that letter that Bob read yesterday. Well, getting at some basic, though, about why this theme has been the focus point of this retreat and why it's been that way, actually, even though we've had many different themes over the years at retreats. As Duncan, as you said earlier, the reality is that that thing, like Ram Dass used to, as soon as he'd speak about soul, he'd look at the Buddhist on his right.
Yeah.
I'm so sorry that we're talking about soul. I know you don't. And that would enliven the conversation around, you know, the intersection really of the tradition of bhakti and Buddhism. And so one of the things that we established early on here at this retreat was it's easy to go into bhakti and do a lot of end-arounds, right, in terms of heart and in terms of what our day-to-day experience is in moving through and transforming emotional difficulties, habitual patterns, neurotic tendencies. That has to be attended to. So we agreed on that. And then Buddhist Ram Dass used to say all the time, the crystal clarity of Buddhism entraps people in their minds and they are bypassing their heart. So there's a bypass going on potentially in each of these practices, and the how do we bring them together is the core of what we've been talking about this weekend.
There's a funny twist here, you know, for me personally, which is, only in tantric Buddhism do we talk about guru. There is no guru in the Hinayana and Mahayana traditions. So there's a Kalyanamitra, like spiritual friend, and a preceptor. So all of a sudden, the embodiment of a particular, of a human being, actually, somebody in a body, becomes key to your progression on your path. And in that way, it's very similar. I have more kinship with your tribe on that point than I do with the Theravadan and Mahayana schools.
Yeah,
that's something that's more in common. And but what you know, you can clear. You use clarity to clear something away, debris. You know, and this thing about soul is a pretty easy one from a Buddhist perspective. I haven't heard anybody really address it like doctrinally. I mean, Professor Thurman could do it. But Buddha's main teaching was anatman, you know, no atman. Mm-hmm. It wasn't ego. There wasn't such a word then really, or soul.
Yeah.
So what is atman? That would be, and is there such a thing or not, would be the key point in that conversation. Is there a... And what my understanding of it is, you would have a deeper one, is a permanent, independent, self-existing sense of a solid identity. Is that so?
It's like the end around still.
Yeah?
That we're going to take that I that we identify with.
Right.
That is, as Krishnadas talks about, the movie of me, which Duncan and I have been working on for years talking about. That is not
Atman.
That is not Atman.
But so, what is Atman? Is it?
Actually, I have no idea. Of course, I have no idea. But
it's a specific word that's describing a specific.
We are all doing this work to discover that the nature of that true self, whatever you want to call. I'm more prone to do that than soul because of my. In my entire life, my interest has been more in that direction. But after meeting Maharaji, I know absolutely everything is possible. There is nothing that's not possible. And it's just whatever gets sent my way to give me a more profound understanding of what that true nature is. I don't care so much about the names.
Okay, I understand. Duncan.
Yes?
So, self, what about it?
What about it? What do you mean? Like identity?
Yeah, is there a fixed identity? A pure identity, a true nature of Duncan that exists somehow permanently, eternally?
There was, but I sold it.
You sold it?
That's when I became a Buddhist. Yeah. You know, I don't look. I knew it.
Don't say that
I
we're in the Bible Belt.
I think that there's so many definitions floating around here that it would be easy to get lost in all those definitions. And I love what you've taught me about absolute and relative reality. Yeah. Or I think, and I always mispronounce it, but I remember when I was studying Bhakti Yoga, there was some term that meant simultaneous oneness and difference, which kind of reminds me of the same thing. And like when you're talking about the wonders of the infinite wonders that you have both, witnessed in your own way, I think one of those is that the universe is expressing itself as temporary, fleeting, transient individuals, and obviously as some whole, which, it's happening at the same time. When you're talking about this conceptualization of theism or absolute reality and nihilism, you're talking about how within that kind of system, you can get stuck in one or the other. You can get so hyper-condensed into your identity. You're trying to be your Twitter bio or something. You're, I forgive, but I never forget. That's who I am, right? That's me or whatever it is. And then you get condensed into that. And you, it hurts. It hurts. It's like when you're, when you haven't been stretching, you just get all stiff. And but it's also, you could run away from that into this, like, well, I'm nothing at all. And then, I mean, isn't that something that Ram Dass said? Like, look, you need to know your social security number. You got to pay your credit card bill. You, when someone's calling and saying you, like, you owe us money, you can't be like, oh, well, I'm everything. So get it from one of my friends because they're me too. It's so, you know, so I think that all of these, if you want to talk about a trap on both sides of the trap will be getting lost in the terminology to the point where you're living in some kind of congealed, you know, like, I don't know, on Thanksgiving, I haven't done it in a long time. The dressing for the turkey, you know, like it stays out too long. It gets this thick, nasty, congealed crust on the top. That's what happens if you get lost in the terminology. And then, and I remember what Chogyam Trungpa said, if you experience or encounter the real thing, it is not, it's fresh baked bread. It feels like something coming out of the oven. It's just good and fragrant and good. This is how I feel playing with my kids. This is how I feel when, like, my, you know, I'm actually like inspired to create something. Whatever that may be, I don't know. Is that Hahnemann? Is that fundamental goodness? I don't know. But I think that in the, you know, hopefully these practices, when you find yourself at the precipice of the next decision, and it's the decision you always make, that drives you into either a more condensed version of you or drives you out of the reality of your, as Ram Dass said, you're taking the curriculum, you know, it drives you out of the reality of your own life. Whenever you're on the precipice of that, if you can remember, even if you barely understand what it means, love, intention. This time I'm not going to hurt. You know, this time, as much as I can, I'm not going to keep doing that thing that burrows me deeper and deeper into that stinky, crusty stuff on the top of the Thanksgiving dressing. Nobody wants that. It's disgusting. Dogs won't even eat it. So to me, that's where I, you know, anytime I've been around you, Ram Dass or Raghu or my kids or people who are like in the moment and that thing happens, it's like, this is it. Does this last forever? I want it to. But then that's when you start trying to grab it and pocket it. And that's when you want to wear the bead that represents the time you were in the presence of the thing. And, or, you know, sometimes it's so unbearable. You don't think you deserve it. And so then you imagine it never happened or something. But do you know, does that make sense? It's like, I'm interested in the pragmatic application of these things. What does it look like on the ground? What does it look like? And for me, what it looks like is right before I do the thing that has inevitably alienated people around me, has inevitably made me win, maybe, or but certainly long term has just made my life dim. You know, anytime these teachings like help me stop doing that, even if I'd still continue to do it, but less. This is where it becomes really interesting to me, because that's when stuff really starts lighting up. That's when you really see Einstein's hippie love light everywhere. And that's, to me, where this, you know, stuff really makes sense.
Yeah. One other great, Bob's definition of love is worth mentioning right now, which is the will to make others happy.
Yes.
That is great. The big deal to me right there, because that's the action, that's getting out. It's what you and I have been talking about with, as Krishnadas's movie of me all these years. It's the action that takes you out of that, what Bob called today, the addiction of me, actually. And that, so it entails a being in that place and an action, a will to make others happy. Yeah.
Intention. Hey, David, remember that time we were doing that class? It was one of my worst experiences in the spiritual universe. We're speaking of addiction to ego. We're doing this class, or you were doing a meditation course, and we were doing a podcast or something. And at the time, I was really edgelording. And you said something about intention. Do you remember this? And I said, I don't think intention matters. And I think you said, well, do you remember what you said to me? You said something on the lines of, that's really dumb. And it hurts so bad. And because you were right. And it hurts. And it hurts. But I do love that. You know, the intention of love, or however you want to, if you don't understand love, the intention of like light, enlightenment, lightening up, the intention of helping, whatever it may be, replacing that ego addiction thing with just in that moment, like, how can I help? There must be something I could do here to help. Wow. That's to me, that's the mantra, or that's the feet on the ground thing. If you've managed like me to really work yourself into some pretty, you know, dark places, probably over the course of infinite lifetimes. I'm sure I was robbing graves not that many lifetimes ago.
I just remember something. I'm changing the subject back to Hanuman, by the way.
He's right there.
Hanuman is right here.
He is right there.
I just remembered, it's something Krishnadasa note, and I have noticed that when we were first going to Kanchi, where Maharaji, the temple, was in the Himalaya, it's no longer there. They took it down or something, but over the arch of the entrance, it said, the Advaita Neem Karoli Baba Hanuman Temple. Non-dual? And we were like, non-dual Hanuman? How did that happen? And I am assuming very, very purposeful by Maharaji. And so that gave a whole other insight into what that representation is of Hanuman, the monkey god. Mm. Non-dual. So when you're talking about does he decay and die, or is it, you know, eternal and it's non-dual. So that gives a little bit of a hint there, and maybe more of a hint. This is just what I was just thinking about, my own predilection for feeling connected to this monkey. You know, it's been amazing all these years. So, right? That's where the Buddhist and Bhakti thing, he put it on the sign, basically.
On the sign.
It's on the sign, yeah. Mm-hmm. It used to be, anyhow.
Yeah, so just to maybe create a slightly different envelope for the conversation. A slightly different envelope. The realm of thought, you know, discursive narrative thought, which is where we spend arguably 99% of our time. I mean, just simply looking at that is, what are we doing most of the time thinking, right? About this or that or the other thing. So in Buddhism, that's called the sixth consciousness. First five are just the sense perceptions, the way they are. So when you see something, you don't need to develop a narrative about it in order to interact with it in a very pure way. It's called pure perception. And the simple practice of somehow reducing our addiction to that discursive mind, either through devotional practice or through, you know, mindfulness type of practices, awareness practices, and not to try to annihilate it or destroy it or think of it as a problem, but it's just like an overgrown thicket. And I think, can everybody relate to that idea that the discursive mind is like really thick and heavy and creates a lot of stories that we get trapped in? Just a simple way of looking at it. So we start pruning that one way or another, and if you can do that without thinking of it as a bad thing or something that you have to repress, that's really good. You know, that's the right way to do that. But just to see the space element in it, the spacious element in it. And that really requires somehow or other slowing down, because it has a lot of speed. The way our discursive mind is sort of goes, it has a lot of inertia, right, and momentum and speed. So some kind of practice where you settle. And then, you know, the way that the mantra's role here is you're bringing your mind back to the mantra. The mantra means mind protection. So the way we're doing the mantras in the evening is just to keep your mind sort of circulating with the mantras. And if you get lost and, oh, I don't, my car, I forgot where my car is parked, and I'd have to be in back in, you know, Virginia tomorrow morning, and I'm going to miss my plane, and Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, you come back. And I told KD one time, I said, you're really teaching shamatha style practice there, because you're saying bring your mind back to the mantra. And shamatha, the object of the meditation doesn't have to be the breath necessarily. It could be anything. It could be a mantra. It could be a visual cue, any of the sense fields. So I just think there might be a universal way for us all to just go, let's settle in a little, agree that we're moving too fast as a culture, and create some kind of restabilizing practice. And that could be pretty broad and pretty simple. No?
Yes.
Yeah? Mm-hmm. So, you know, we're ingesting here a lot of ideas from a lot of people. And I know this morning everybody sat a little bit, yes? Did you do some sitting practice, just sitting? Yeah, how did that feel? We should do that regularly as a group, right? Just make sure that we're leaving some space to just be and experience each other and the warmth of getting together as friends, sangha. That transcends really anything we're going to characterize here, in my opinion.
Yes.
There was one other thing that I wanted to bring up, because part of what we're doing, as you were talking about uncovering, and Spring Washam talked about it, Sharon Salzberg, Bob, everybody, that's the process. And one of the, of course, most important of the Buddhist principles and most valuable is around constant change, anitya, impermanence. And it's, we haven't really talked about that so far, right? And I was just thinking about it because myself, I became, this morning in the first session when Spring led that meditation, I was tired and I started to nod, you know, and just feeling, you know, when you have tiredness in your body, it was uncomfortable. So I started thinking about, wow, this is really uncomfortable. And I thought, I'm sitting there in a mindfulness meditation, I can't just ignore it. So I thought, okay, I'll just be with it. And notice that the beauty of impermanence, it's not that just the joyous, pleasurable stuff won't last. The shitty stuff doesn't last either, right? And sure enough, it started to change. I could feel it change, you know, as I let go of the tiredness. But I think there's such a practical application for us, even in something as small as that was for me. I think it serves to help just get a little bit more friendly, shall we say, with discomfort and suffering. How about a little comment on that, Mr. Nickturn?
How about Duncan?
Duncan, yeah.
Oh, great. Well, you know, your book, David, Awakening from the Daydream. I love it. It's the Buddhist wheel of life, but, you know, not just looked at literally the realm of the gods, the human realm, animal realm, jealous gods, hell realms, but also how we cycle through those throughout the day, you know. And since I've read that book, I've gotten into some of the like traditional scriptures, and the depiction of like the realm of the gods and the hell realms are interesting in that there's this change seems to be happening in a slower way. And people might think this is a good thing, but this results in a kind of quality of being trapped. You know, if you're stuck, you know, if you have this infinite lifespan and you're able to experience whatever sense gratification you're looking for at any given moment, as delightful as that might seem, if you read it for the first time, it actually, I think there's a reason the realm of the gods and the mandala is like parallel to the hell realms, because both of them, what they have in common is this stuckness. The thing that horrifies people, change, or that can be so terrifying, is actually start removing that or slowing it down, fulfill the transhumanist dream of becoming an eternal being or turning your brain into silicon or something like that. And pretty soon you're going to realize you've essentially frozen yourself in ice, which is one of the hell realms. So yeah, change is something that is should be celebrated. And, you know, and I do think that this is where the headbutting will start between the bhaktis and the Buddhists, is because a Buddhist might say, look, really, you have this unchanging eternal soul? You want that? That's bad news. You're trapped. That's stuck. You're like Han Solo in the whatever it was, that thing Jabba the Hutt put him in. You want that? You don't want that. You want your soul to get old, fat, start losing its hair, and eventually die, or you are in trouble, man. You know, you don't want the thing to go on forever. So I think, yeah, change as something that is not only just to be celebrated, but without that in every quantum aspect of what we are, then that means that we are essentially trapped in hell. There is no possibility of anything other than whatever this eternal, unchanging thing that people call the soul, which isn't actually good news. Let's hope that's not the case.
Well, Duncan, without using any of these, you know, triggering concepts, you know, that people might think of a certain way, just a simple Buddhist analysis would be that the source of suffering is grasping and fixation. That's what creates suffering. Just if you just take that home, when you grasp and you fixate, you create suffering down the line. And it doesn't matter what you're grasping or fixating onto. But within the relative world, it's better to grasp and fixate onto sort of more positive things.
Right.
If you're going to grasp and fixate, why don't you grasp and fixate onto the idea of being kind or being gentle or being compassionate?
You know, also, and I'm sorry, I know Han Solo is triggering to people. I'm sorry about that. But the other, in thinking about this stuff, I imagine if people were more aware of the transient nature of things and the ecological disasters that are happening, even though sadly they're happening faster and are exponentially going to happen faster. Imagine if we had the capacity to see the way these systems are changing, because if you aren't looking at graphs or grids or, you know, a series of pictures showing like shrinking glaciers or whatever, you might not even recognize how quickly things are changing. And in that lack of recognition or ignorance, then you aren't quite as motivated to act, to do something. And obviously it doesn't just apply to the environment. It applies to the interpersonal environment in your own life and to your body and to everything. Like this is, I mean, you know, in general, when you hear qualities of someone who has been given a terminal diagnosis and is close to death, it's very rare that you hear someone say, oh, they became a complete jerk. Oh, they were horrible. You didn't, like, when people are close to death, they just become so mean. I know it happens sometimes, but my experience with it has been this clarity, this lucidity, this, I don't want to say seriousness, but a sense of like wanting to get into the truth as quickly as possible appears. And so if that appears because someone is close to dropping their body and they know it, then really that would imply that if we became aware of that prior to the diagnosis, then maybe that would inspire a similar kind of way of being. There wouldn't be such an attitude of procrastination when it came to getting down to the point of things.
So I hate to be, because I want to address, you brought that topic up, and it's probably more accurate to include, when you talk about impermanence, the notion of continuity as well. That's the dance. Because The word tantra, gyur in Tibetan, means continuity. Something is continuing. Mm-hmm. That's where everybody could sort of, with clarity of mind, you see there's no real discrepancy between the idea of continuity and the idea of impermanence. Mm. But what is it that's continuing is what you were saying. That's what you're trying to find, right?
Yeah.
At the beginning, weren't you saying that?
Yeah, in simpler terms. Yeah. I'm not, you know, continuity, I mean, that's a big word.
Yeah.
Just in terms, true nature is much more relatable to me. You know, who am I behind the I that is in the day-to-day process of believing in thoughts and stories and falling back on habitual tendencies?
You're so my bubbler, Raghu.
I know that, Dave.
So you are.
Yeah, so
yeah, you know.
Yeah, we're both saying the same thing. Yeah.
But impermanence would be the nihilistic one. Continuity could be the theistic uh-huh. one. But if you can put them together into a sense of being, our being is pervaded by impermanence, like the way Duncan's talking about it, and it's also pervaded by a sense of continuity, sometimes a false sense of continuity mm-hmm. based on a small sense of self.
Yeah.
Does that make
That's
sense?
That's the key right there. Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Duncan, it may be painful, but we both really love you.
I love you guys. Are you kidding? That's not painful. It used to be a long time ago. I'll take it, man. I love you guys. I love you so much. Are you kidding? Mm.
You know, speaking about love, actually, I've always wanted to ask you something about love.
Okay. Yeah.
So there's a story from Ram Dass at one point at Naropa in 74 when he made his those first talks and retreat about the Bhagavad Gita at Naropa when it opened. He said at one point we were driving somewhere and I had to go somewhere and I was in a car full of his Trungpa students. And you know, they had been making fun of me all whenever I talked about Maharaji Neem Karoli Baba in the way that I talked about him in the bhakti devotional sense. So I shut up and I'm in the car, he says, and suddenly his students are speaking of him in exactly the same term and endearment that I would have, you know, with Maharaji. And I went, aha.
Yeah.
I see what's going on, but I've never asked you. And so David is a student of Trungpa Rinpoche's and spent a bunch of time with him. And what is your love relationship there?
Well, we call it unrequited.
Unrequited.
Does that ring a bell?
No.
You can never get back that which you need to project onto that person. It'll never come back that way.
Mm-hmm. So how is that?
It's like loving a mirror.
Yeah, right.
You want to make out with the mirror. You want to take the mirror home. You want to domesticate the mirror. And the mirror just stays very lucid, you know?
In my experience, that's one aspect of it. There was another aspect which went beyond the reflection completely into another zone, which I couldn't identify at all. So I am sure that that zone was going on with Trungpa, no?
Well, I mean, this is, in a way, I feel like we've been waiting years to have this chat, you know, it's so great.
We haven't had it, yeah.
But I think it would be undying and unconditional love that mixes with the heart at the level of relational love. You know, this is the funniest person, the most delightful person, the most challenging person, the most enduring person, even if they die, it doesn't seem to matter all that much. Mm. I think that's a similarity. Trungpa Rinpoche, in Vajrayana Buddhism, you do a guru yoga practice where the guru is sitting on top of your head, but is facing this, or she is facing the same way as you are. Mm. So it's like the mixing of the minds. Mm. And at that point, I think the non-dual, the Advaita thing is like,
that's it.
Could you say that, you know, that Maharaji is really a separate thing at this point in your life? Isn't it part of your fabric too?
Yeah, no. Yeah. That is the absolute truth of the Advaita part that was on that sign. It's not a me and you. There's the polarization is gone.
But the vehicle for that losing the polarization is the Guru Jnana. That's because only a human being can really show you that.
Yeah.
But I mean, you can make a leap. Some people have made this leap and somehow risen with this complete non-dual understanding of reality.
Very few.
But
yeah.
Very few.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But in this that's why what we got back then, which was the grounding in Vipassana particularly, because we were all going to those courses, and how he used to encourage, and Krishnas told the story of the other day of him. He had a notebook and he had written part of Mahamudra. Did mm-hmm. you hear that? You heard that?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then he had it translated and Maharaja said, teak, you know, that's mm-hmm. right on. And then to turn the page, it wasn't a stamp. Krishnas can't remember some of these stories. I was there. There was a picture of him. Okay. And that's when he said, who's that? And we mm-hmm. were like, huh? Mm-hmm. It's you. He goes, Buddha, named Buddha. Buddha. So we had, from the earliest stages of our, shall we say, training with him, in the earliest stages, that became a prominent aspect of what it was that we started to embody.
Right.
And now here we are with all of Ram Dass's best friends were Buddhist, okay? And we all had relationship with them as well. You know, I was with Joseph, introduced me to Manindra back in that day at a course in Bodh Gaya. So to have that as a nutshell, and I think, you know, I do believe we've been sharing this in retreat for many, many years, and we sort of have brought it out of the closet a little bit. Duncan?
Yes?
Are you with us?
Yeah, what? Yeah, I'm with you. I mean, I love it. Well, that was beautiful. I love hearing y'all talk. It truly, one of my favorite things of these retreats is just eavesdropping these conversations between bhaktis and Buddhists there. You all are like just infinitely trying to unravel whatever this thing is. And it's just it could be a sport almost. It's really cool to watch. I love it. It's wonderful.
Oh, I want to, because we're close to the end of the session, please, because I think this, when we're talking about unraveling and the ways in which we can unravel the stuff that prevents us from even approaching unity in the heart, it's practice. And we've been talking about it for the entire time we've been here and the importance of it. And I just wanted to mention, and David has some wonderful courses coming up that please do let us know how we can access them.
So just in a nutshell, and by way of inviting all of you, the platform we've created is called Dharma Moon. So you can go to dharmamoon.com. It's all happening there. And what we have starting is a mindfulness meditation teacher training program that's 100 hours. It's 5 weekends. It starts October 1st. You can take the first weekend as a standalone. It's a good overview. And our goal is just to get people grounded into the basic practice of mindfulness meditation as the foundation for anything else that we're going to talk about.
Yeah.
So, and how to communicate it skillfully to other people without getting them more confused than they already were. That's the sort of target of the program. And Duncan has helped us to, there's just been a natural synergy in the people who he has a weekly meditation. And Duncan and I are going to do an info session on Wednesday at 6 p.m. See you right on the front page of dharmamoon.com. And if you're interested, we'll tell you more about that program. Everybody here, we completely welcome. And I don't think you have to think of it as, oh, now I'm betraying the bhakti and becoming a Buddhist.
No, he sold his soul. He admitted it. Come on.
But it's true that mindfulness is a foundation that's good for the whole family, and good mixer goes with everything.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Just stabilizing your mind a little bit, you know. So you're all welcome to just check out dharmamoon.com. You'll see the whole thing. And I want to thank Duncan, who it's like picking up a hitchhiker and then you realize that they're part of your family.
That's good.
You got a cigarette, man? I'm your brother.
So, you know, in both these traditions, loyalty is a really important quality in the Sangha, and that we just help each other out and have some kind of, even through rough patches, you know. So I really treasure these retreats. And Raghu has been the glue, in my estimation, holding this together. And through a very difficult transition, you know, which is Ram Dass passing away. And what's interesting, he and I were talking about it, it's expanded since then, which is, and I shared with Raghu, there's this phrase in the Buddhist world, when the guru dies, they say that that person enters the action. They become more accessible.
I love that. Yeah.
So if you were looking for Ram Dass, it's all over the place. If you're looking for Maharaji, if you're looking for all the saints and siddhas, they're right here with us. Even Hanuman has been right up there for most of the talk that we've had going on here. So, you know, we're not isolated. We're part of a much larger fabric. And so thank you, Raghu, for including me
Thanks,
in that.
Thanks, David.
Appreciate
thank
it.
Thank you. Can you just tell me one thing before we leave?
Yes.
This concept of loyalty.
Yes. And
what is that called? I've never really heard that.
Well, I guess people would call it devotion or commitment. Uh-huh. That you don't be too fickle and don't give up. Like my teacher said, I never give up on anybody ever at all.
Trump.
Yeah. Really? I never give up on anybody. So, of course, we're showing each other our inner gederim and our dirty underwear and all that stuff. So you could go, oh, this person's not worthy or they pissed me off or something like that. But if you're in a sangha together, you have to transcend that. So that's what I mean by loyalty.
That's right on. Sentiment for sure, for sure. Duncan, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
You guys can find Duncan, as I said, Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast. We just did one that just came out on my Mind Rolling podcast with Duncan, talking about these last 6 or 7 years of our work together. And, you know, really happy to have your podcast too. What's it called?
Creativity, Spirituality, and Making a Buck.
Okay. Talk about practicality. Yeah. Yeah. David's book is of the same title is phenomenal too. So thanks, everybody. We'll see you next time.
Bye, Duncan.